way to the Collins Inn. There, Harris parked on the street and watched Ananka walk from the Mustang into the building. Deputy M. Harris, you just made my list. The clerk behind the desk was a college-aged guy who, at the sound of the door swishing open, looked up from a TV and quickly stood when he realized he had a customer. Good morning, he said with a lot more cheer than Harris had managed. How can I help you?
Check in, Ian.
Do you have a reservation? She gave him the pertinent information, and he gave her a pair of key cards to room 312. Before she could walk away, he said, We have a reservation linked to yours for a Caroline Cruz arriving later this morning. We have her staying in the room next to yours.
Great, thank you.
Those rooms have connecting doors. If you'd rather have something more private, I could arrange that.
Nope, connecting doors are fine. Thanks again.
7 minutes later, Ananka was sound asleep. Rosario arrived at SeaTac International Airport at 8:30 a.m. after spending a grand total of 34 hours in Mexico City. That had barely been enough time to get some decent food, a few hours of rest, and to make sure her absence over the last couple of weeks hadn't resulted in anyone raiding one of the stashes of equipment and valuables she'd hidden around the city. When the administrator had contacted her about another job, her inclination was to tell him not this time. Trust was not something that came easily to Rosario. The administrator and the organization he represented had a long way to go to earn that from her. But when he told her Ananka was already on board, Rosario had reconsidered. While she hadn't known Ananka any longer than she'd known the administrator, she'd worked with Ananka on two missions already, and in that short time had developed considerable respect for the woman. If Ananka had said yes, then Rosario wanted to be at her side. She made her way to the appropriate departure wing and headed to her gate.
Well, hey now, look who's here!
Ricky Orbitz waved at her from inside a bar along the walkway.
Come, join me for a drink. We've got plenty of time.
He patted the stool next to him. The administrator had warned her Ricky would be on this flight, and that since their cover identities weren't supposed to know each other, it would be best if they ignored each other. Cursing under her breath, she scanned the area to make sure no one was paying them undue attention. Her internal threat radar remained silent, so she reluctantly walked into the bar. She did not sit.
Whatever you're drinking, I'm buying,
Ricky said, a half-empty pint of beer in front of him.
What are you doing?
What does it look like I'm doing? What are you doing?
She narrowed her eyes and whispered,
We do not know each other.
He frowned.
Really? I wasn't told that.
I was told.
She turned to leave.
Wait, you're already here. Just one drink. If anyone asks, we'll say I was trying to hit on you.
The thought of that sent a shiver up her spine, but walking away now might draw more attention than if she stayed for a bit.
Fine.
She flagged down the bartender.
An orange juice, please.
Orange juice, Ricky said. How about a shot of vodka in that?
The bartender paused, looking at them.
It is 8:45 a.m., Rosario said.
So? Ricky asked.
She glanced at the bartender.
Orange juice, no vodka.
While the man went to get her drink, Ricky snickered.
Not a morning drinker either, huh?
She eyed his beer.
Oh, this is an exception, he said defensively. Did you know that the Charis Ivanis is a dry ship? Can you believe that?
Part of the deal allowing Ricky to be sprung from prison and be part of the team was that between missions, he was restricted to the ship, the Charis Ivanis, that served as the team's floating headquarters.
I do not care, she said.
Ah, come on, Rosie, you can't be that heartless.
As he raised his beer to his lips, she said,
What is your problem? Why can you never call anyone by their proper name? It is annoying and rude. Everyone thinks this.
He started to snort, but caught himself before beer could spew out of his mouth and nose. With great difficulty, he swallowed, then said,
Not everyone.
Everyone, you need to stop.
Has anyone told you you're too serious?
The bartender returned with the orange juice. Rosario drank it down without stopping.
From this point forward, I am Caroline Cruz, and you are Rudy Schmidt, and we do not know each other.
Can you believe that name, Rudy Schmidt? Sounds like I should be serving bratwurst at Soldier Field.
Turning away, she said,
I am going to the gate now.
Wait up, I'm almost done.
She kept walking.
Upon landing in Spokane, Rosario proceeded to the Hertz rental counter and picked up the car that had been reserved for her, avoiding any further encounters with Ricky. He'd been seated at the back of the plane, far from her. Thank you, Mr. Administrator. So she had walked as quickly as possible to make sure their paths didn't cross. She did see him one more time before reaching Bradbury. A few miles north of Spokane, he raced by on a motorcycle, beeping as he passed. At the Collins Inn, she picked up a key to room 314 and was told her colleague was staying in the room next door. The rooms turned out to have adjoining doors, so as soon as she finished freshening up, she opened the one on her side and knocked on the other. A moment later, a deadbolt slipped free and the door swung open. "You made it," Ananka said, smiling. After a hug, she motioned Rosario into her room. "Any problems?" Ananka asked as they walked over to a sitting area where an opened laptop sat on a table. "Other than Ricky? No." Ananka paused mid-step. "Ricky? We were on the same flight from Seattle." "Please tell me he got thrown off mid-flight. If only we were so lucky." Ananka snickered and Rosario joined in, and soon both were laughing loudly. When they finally calmed down, Rosario relayed what had happened on the trip to Bradbury, ending with, "He passed me a long time ago, so he should be here by now. Has he checked in yet?" "Of course not." Ananka grabbed her phone and shot off a text. "What about Dylan and Liesl?" "Due in tomorrow." Ananka's phone buzzed. "Well, look at that. Ricky is here." "Is he staying in this hotel?" "Yeah, but I made it clear to the administrator I didn't want him anywhere near us." She sent another message, and the response came back within seconds. "He's in room 201, which is on the other side of the hotel."
"Good."
"Definitely."
"So," Rosario said, "do we wait for everyone to arrive, or..."
"Absolutely not." Ananka woke up her computer. On the screen was a Google map of Bradbury, with several manually added markers scattered across it. Ananka pointed at one. "This is Natasha Patterson's home. It's in a development at the north end of town. I drove through the area last night. Big lawns, a nice car in every driveway. Quiet."
"Sounds boring."
"No kidding."
"What is the status of her place at the moment?"
"As far as I know, no one's been inside since she disappeared." Ananka pointed at a pair of markers along the highway a bit farther north. "These two buildings belong to Skolarian. Natasha worked in the east building, second floor. I have Shinji working on obtaining floor plans."
"I can help, if need be."
"Let him do it. Makes him feel useful." Ananka pointed at the marker farthest north. "Way up here is where Kyle Scudder lives. It's a gated community called Green Hills Estates."
"Any word on whether there is a boyfriend?"
"Nothing."
"Girlfriend?"
"Same answer." "The administrator told you about the Davos connection, right?"
"Yes."
"Good." Ananka motioned at the map. "The other markers are places she's mentioned to him. Cafes she's eaten at, the market she frequents, a bookstore. Not sure any of those are going to help us, though. What we really need to figure out is where she was the night she went missing."
"Do we know where her phone is?"
Ananka shook her head. "The administrator told me that it hasn't shown up on any system since the evening of the 5th.
"I will double-check the records and get a final location." "There was no mobile number in the brief I received. Do you have that?"
"I do." Ananka accessed the information on her phone and texted it to Rosario. "There is one other thing you can look into for me."
"Of course."
Ananka told her about the encounter she'd had with the cop the night before. The name on her badge read M. Harris. I'd like you to see what you can find out about her.
"Easy enough."
Rosario paused, still troubled by something she'd been thinking about since she left Mexico.
"I am still confused about what our mission is here.
I understand that a woman might be missing, but is this not something the police should handle?" "Normally, yes. But because someone has been posing as her, at least with emails and texts, there's no reason for most people to think she's missing. Add in that the administrator thinks there's something larger going on, and here we are."
"Larger? Like what?"
"Apparently, that's up to us to figure out." What Ananka really wanted to do was get a look inside the missing woman's house. There must be clues there to indicate if she was missing or simply on a trip. But that was a task best left until after dark. For now, Ananka would have to settle for establishing the cover story the administrator had given her. While Rosario set to work reviewing the phone records,
Ananka drove back through the old part of town to a Victorian house off Main Street that had been converted into an office. She parked in the small lot beside the building and entered. A teenage girl sat behind a desk in the center of the front room, engrossed in one of the thicker Harry Potter books. Ananka waited for the girl to look up, but the teen remained glued to the page. Not wanting to wait for Hermione to pull Harry out of yet another mess, Ananka said, "Hello?" The girl looked up, startled.
Oh,
she jammed an index card into the book to mark her page before saying,
Good afternoon, how may I help you?
Using the slight Texas twang her cover identity required, Ananka said,
I'm looking for Antonia Mahoney. Of course.
The girl popped up with an exuberance only a person her age could muster and dashed into the hallway behind the desk. She was gone for no more than 2 seconds before she popped her head back around the corner.
Do you have an appointment?
She should be expecting me. Tell her it's Sean Raimi.
Sean Raimi, got it. I'll be right back.
Ananka occupied herself by looking around the small lobby, taking in first a large landscape painting of what she guessed was a local area, and then the long, expensive-looking sign with raised letters on the opposite wall that read, Mahoney Realty, the Bradbury Experts. That should have given the receptionist more than enough time to return, and yet Ananka remained alone. On the desk was a bowl of packaged candies. She snapped up a mini peanut butter cup, unwrapped it, and popped it into her mouth. Still no receptionist. Ananka moved around the desk and peeked into the hall. Empty. She grabbed a second chocolate and took her time eating it. When she finished, she checked the hall again. Not a soul in sight. Though she'd had no appointment, she'd been told the realtor would be expecting Ms. Raimi at some point that morning. Given the size of the potential commissions Ananka's visit represented, however fake they were, Ananka had expected the agent to come rushing out at the mention of her name. Enough of this BS, Ananka headed into the hallway. The corridor opened into another room not far down, perhaps a parlor back in the day, or the dining room. It had been converted into a four-desk bullpen. A middle-aged balding guy in a business suit occupied one of the desks, while the others were empty. Ananka felt safe in assuming he wasn't Antonia Mahoney. A female voice drifted into the room from another hall to the right. Ananka followed it, past a couple of empty offices, to the open doorway at the very end.
That's more than fine, the voice was saying. Of course, I understand. We'll just reschedule for next week.
Ananka stopped shy of the threshold and peered in. The receptionist stood fidgeting, her back to the door, in front of a desk that dominated the room. The girl was watching a 40-something woman with perfectly coiffed hair talking on the phone. The woman also faced the other direction, looking out the window. Ananka leaned against the doorframe. Problem? The teen swiveled around, her eyes widening.
Oh, Miss Raintree, I'm sorry, it'll just be another minute.
The woman behind the desk, Antonia Mahoney, presumably, turned and looked from the receptionist to Ananka and back.
Mr. Drake, if you could hold for one moment.
She put her hand over the phone and whispered,
Karina, what's going on?
Sorry, Mrs. Mahoney, this is, Sean Raintree. She said you were expecting her?
Mahoney's brow furrowed.
Raintree?
Raimi, Ananka corrected. Instantly, Mahoney's face brightened.
Miss Raimi, of course, I'm so sorry. I'm just finishing up.
She gestured at the chairs in front of her desk.
Please, have a seat.
Thank you, Ananka said, and took the chair on the left. Karina looked unsure if she should leave or stay. When Mahoney noticed this, she whispered,
See if she wants something to drink.
Oh, right.
Karina smiled at Ananka.
Would you like something to drink? We have water and, Diet Coke and,
Water is fine, Ananka said. The girl hurried out and returned with the bottle as Mahoney wrapped up her phone conversation. Karina handed the bottle to Ananka and once more seemed puzzled about her next move.
You can go back to your desk, Mahoney said.
Yes, ma'am.
As soon as the girl was out of the room, Mahoney put a hand at the side of her mouth and stage whispered to Ananka.
High school work-study program. Her first job. At least I don't have to pay her.
The realtor smiled and came around the desk, hand extended.
Antonia Mahoney, a pleasure to meet you.
Ananka stood and shook. Sean Raimi,
I appreciate you taking the time to see me, Mrs. Mahoney.
Tony motioned back at Ananka's seat and retreated to her own chair.
It's my pleasure, and please call me Tony.
Tony. Tony Mahoney?
Cute, isn't it?
Tony said without any irony at all.
Trying to sound convincing, Ananka said,
Sure.
Tony clicked open a file on her computer.
How was the trip here?
Fine. Beautiful country.
I understand you drove in.
That's right, last night.
The good news is that we're expanding our airport, and by late summer we'll have daily commuter flights to and from Spokane. Much better for businesses.
That's good to hear.
Tony smiled. We may look like a small town, but we're larger than people think. Now let's see.
She studied her screen.
I have the specifications of what your company is looking for, unless those have changed?
No, you have the latest.
Ananka's cover was that of a tech executive looking for a new research facility.
As far as Tony knew, Bradbury was only one of several potential locations on Ananka's list.
In that case, there shouldn't be any problem finding exactly what you're looking for. I made a list of about a dozen properties that should suit your needs, some already finished and some ready for development.
That's encouraging.
Can I just say, you have come to the right place at the right time. Bradbury is truly special. Not only am I confident you'll find your perfect property, but I know you will soon realize you've found your perfect town for your employees as well. Honestly, we have so much to offer.
She paused, a sparkle dancing across her eyes.
I hope you don't mind, but the Chamber of Commerce and I have set up a welcome party for tomorrow evening, a kind of meet and greet with some of the town's movers and shakers.
What a great idea. That sounds wonderful.
It did not sound wonderful, but it did sound useful.
I'm glad you approve.
The heads of several companies that have moved here in recent years will be there. Also, the mayor and the chief of police.
She leaned forward and, in what was apparently a signature move, stage whispered,
I think there's a good chance Kyle Scudder will come, too.
The head of Scalarian?
One and the same.
Fantastic. This time, Ananka was not blowing smoke. I'll look forward to finding out how he and the others feel about relocating here.
I can tell you that right now. They all love Bradbury.
Tony laughed.
I don't know what your schedule is, but if you're free right now, I could show you some of those properties.
I am free, but I think that can wait. What I'd really appreciate is a tour of the town, something to help me get a feel of the place.
What an excellent idea!
6.
Consciousness returned in dribs and drabs, slowly stealing Tasha from the comforting arms of sleep. At least her head wasn't throbbing as badly as all the other times she'd woken since being caught in the woods. She'd had moments when she was sure her skull was on the verge of splitting. Lying there, eyes still closed, she realized the intense vertigo that had greeted her every day for the last week, 10 days, a month, seemed to have subsided. She didn't know those first several days had been a blur. She winced as she rolled onto her back. Her ribcage was still bruised, so that hadn't changed. Slowly, she parted her eyelids and realized something was different. Gone was the white plaster ceiling she'd been staring at. The ceiling now was bare concrete. She looked to the side. Before, she'd been in a small room with a boarded-up window. This place was larger, containing oddly shaped items she couldn't quite make out with her cloudy mind from her prone position. Tasha sat up and swung her legs off the bed. Not a real bed, she saw now. A canvas-covered cot propped up on a wooden frame. Odd. Something hung in the air between her and the rest of the room. Glass? Maybe, but it had no frame, and wasn't just in front of her, but continued above and to the sides. The only place it was absent from was on the floor. It was like she was in a giant see-through box that was barely tall enough for her to stand in beside the cot, but plenty long enough for the portable bed. She guessed the roof topped out half a foot above her at around 6 feet. She touched the wall. Not glass, plexiglass, set into a groove that ran along the floor. She sucked in a deep breath and another as panic bloomed in her chest. Stop it, get a hold of yourself.
Her situation had already been dire, so there was no sense in losing her head over a change of scenery. Besides,
Panic meant allowing someone else to control you. What she needed was to be the one in charge, to focus her energies on figuring out how to escape. She pushed against the wall, hoping to tip the enclosure over, but her shove not only failed, it shot a crippling wave of pain across her ribcage. She leaned against the wall to keep from falling and wrapped an arm across her chest, her eyes squeezed shut as the spasms washed over her. When they finally dissipated, she opened her eyes again and took a long look at the area beyond her transparent cell. Spaced evenly throughout the place were nearly a dozen other identical containers. They weren't on the ground at all. Each is set on its own platform, and under the few she could see, there were wheels. Most of the enclosures were empty, but three held other prisoners, all motionless on their cots. Tasha banged on the wall.
Hey! Hey, wake up!
None of the others even twitched. She pounded and yelled a few more times, but either they were too far away to hear her, or the plexiglass cells were soundproof. A light change across the room drew her attention. A door along the far wall had opened, and through it walked two men, both wearing dark blue jumpsuits and Halloween masks. They headed straight to Tasha's cell and stopped beside it. The one wearing an alien mask touched something out of sight below the lip of her platform, and then twisted up a gooseneck stand.
Back on the dead!
His voice boomed from a speaker in the floor of Tasha's platform.
Let me out! She yelled. You can't keep me like this! This is kidnapping! That's a fed-
Back on the dead or fall where you are!
She didn't know what he meant, nor did she care. She slapped the wall.
Let me out, damn it! Let me out right now!
A hiss, like a bike tire being drained of air. She twisted left and right, looking for the source, and froze when she saw a mist rising at the other end of the cell. She had no idea what it was, but was sure it would put her back to sleep. As she turned to the cot, the whole world went wobbly. She stumbled, her leg whacking against the cot's railing. For a second, she was convinced she would fall, but she willed herself forward and was able to tumble into the cot mere seconds before everything went black. 7. Tony Mahoney gestured at a brick structure on the left side of the road.
That's the oldest building in town. The Preservation Society took it over about a decade ago. Good thing, too. It had been close to collapsing at the time. They shored it up, and over the following years, they raised enough money to return it to its former state, with most of the funds coming from our new businesses. Now it serves as the city museum.
Hoping she sounded convincing, Ananka said, What a nice story. I'll make a point of stopping by.
They're not always open. But if you tell me when you want to visit, I can make sure someone's there.
Great, thank you. Tony smiled and pointed again.
That two-story building is City Hall, and the ones next to it are the fire department and the police department.
Ananka took special note of the police station. There were two squad cars out front, and an open area around the side she didn't have a good angle on, but where she guessed would be a few more department vehicles. How many firemen and police officers does the city employ?
I don't know the actual number, but I think it's around 25 each. That would include office staff, too, of course.
Of course. After downtown, Tony drove Ananka through the new housing area where Patterson lived. All the roads had cutesy names like Binary Place and Motherboard Lane. Someone must have thought they would appeal to the tech transplants. Ananka had her doubts.
Wonderful floor plans and all the latest appliances, Tony was saying. Solar, too, if you didn't notice. That's free of charge, by the way.
Free of charge?
Scalarian provides free solar systems to everyone in Bradbury.
Even the older homes?
Even the older homes.
That's generous.
Just another benefit of living here. I believe they're currently installing a system at the new elementary school.
She gazed out the window and pointed ahead.
Right up there is one of the houses we just listed, the one with the sign.
That's actually the first for sale sign in the neighborhood I've seen. How many homes are available here?
In this development, only three at the moment.
What about the ones still being built? Here and there they'd passed homes in various states of construction.
Most of those are already spoken for, but don't let that concern you. Barry, he's the developer, is about to start phase four, which will nearly double the number of houses. By the time you and your employees arrive, we'll have plenty of new places to choose from.
She flashed her realtor smile.
I'd move into this neighborhood myself if I didn't already have a home.
Ahead was Cloud Drive, the street where Patterson lived. Ananka sensed Tony was about to go the other way, so as they neared the corner, she said, "This street looks cute. Do you mind if we take a look?" Perhaps in another setting, her request would have appeared suspicious, but it was perfectly natural for the kind of tour they were on. Tony said, "Of course," without batting an eye, and turned right. "It really is lovely," Ananka said a few minutes later. In truth, she wouldn't be caught dead living here. While the homes did look well-built and even upscale, the construction crews seemed to have been working from only 5 basic blueprints, creating a cookie-cutter neighborhood, Ananka's least favorite kind. As Tony droned on about the benefits of the area, Ananka searched the addresses until she spotted Patterson's place. Big for one person, but Patterson was a CFO, and at the lower prices in the area, she could have probably bought a home twice the size. Patterson had chosen blueprint number 3, a faux craftsman two-story, painted medium gray with white and turquoise trim. The only thing setting it apart from most of the other number 3s was that Patterson's garage sat to the left of the house, not the right. No car in the driveway or out front, but someone clearly had been taking care of the yard, because even with the new spring growth, everything looked trimmed and clean. A gardener service seemed a fair bet, but it would be worth having Shinji check that out. I wonder if she has a maid, too.
"If any of your employees prefers more privacy," the realtor said, "there are plenty of properties outside of town with a little land and no neighbors for as far as they can see."
"I'm sure a few will be interested in that."
"I could take you out that way now if you'd like, so you can get a feel for what I mean."
Ananka pretended to consider the suggestion. "Actually, what I'd love to see is..." She paused, as if trying to recall something.
"I believe it's called Green Hills Estates? For our CEO, of course. I understand that might be an appropriate location."
Tony's eyes lit up at the potential commission for one of the high-end properties.
"It absolutely would be. Be happy to show you that."
Since Rosario knew it would be a simpler task, she tackled checking out Officer Harris first. The M on the woman's name tag stood for Morgan. She was 32 and, except for a 4-year stint in the Army right out of high school, was a lifetime resident of Bradbury. Her parents had owned a hardware shop downtown that went bankrupt 5 years before the local tech boom took hold. Harris's father had taken odd jobs after that and been seriously injured operating a forklift. After surgery, he obtained an infection that, 2 weeks later, claimed his life. Young Morgan took a job at the local grocery store to help her mother out, and when she finished high school, joined the military and regularly sent a large chunk of her earnings home. When she returned to Bradbury, she moved back in with her mother, and the two had lived together until the elder Harris passed away 2 years earlier from cancer. Officer Harris's military service records told of a competent soldier with plenty of commendations and no mentions of disciplinary actions or even minor trouble. After her service ended, she applied to the Bradbury Police Department and was sent to a 6-month academy program in Seattle. Since that time, she'd been one of the 23 officers on the Bradbury PD payroll. The first year, she filled in where needed, but since then had served almost exclusively on the graveyard shift. Her financial records showed her debts were contained to a $35,000 balance on the house she inherited and about $500 due on a single credit card. The only other items Rosario discovered were a handful of mentions in the local paper over the years. Nothing character-revealing, just participation in this or that event and the occasional appearance in the police blotter column as a responding officer. All this boiled down to Harris being a competent public servant who had taken care of her mother until the woman died. Rosario knew Ananka would have liked more, but short of talking to anyone who knew Harris, this was all she'd get for now. Rosario didn't think Ananka would want her nosing around that much yet. Rosario turned her attention to Natasha Patterson's phone. She used a program that rendered her own phone number untraceable and called Patterson's cell. Straight to voicemail. She went online and employed a well-used hack to get into the phone carrier system. Sure enough, the phone was not currently connected to any network, which usually meant it was either off or out of range of any cell towers. Rosario set up a bug that would alert her the moment the phone reconnected. She then navigated to the company's records and found those for Patterson's number. The last tower contact was at 8:07 p.m. on April 5th. After that, the phone was off the system. The last call had occurred at 7:23 p.m. Reverse lookup revealed the receiving number belonged to Brian Patterson. The name was the same as the missing woman's brother. Rosario checked the address and confirmed the number belonged to him. The call had lasted for 12 minutes. Corresponding cell tower information indicated Tasha Patterson had remained within an area covered by a single tower. Rosario coordinated that with a map of Bradbury and confirmed the tower zone included Tasha Patterson's house. Rosario returned to the main record screen. 32 minutes after the call to Brian Patterson ended, at 7:35 p.m., the phone disconnected from the network and had not connected again. Rosario would have to dig a little deeper. Getting into the company's raw data wasn't as easy, but soon enough she was awash in a sea of numbers that made no sense to the naked eye. She brought up a programmable computer worm she'd used under similar circumstances, modified it for her current needs, and sent it into the jumble of information to pull out what she wanted. It ran for 11 minutes before displaying the message it was done. Rosario opened the spreadsheet it had created and raised an eyebrow. She had set the parameters to collect data on Patterson's phone from 6 hours before 8:07 p.m. to 6 hours after. As expected, there was a full list of tower check-ins and data use throughout the afternoon and early evening of April 5th. What shouldn't have been there was any additional data after the cutoff time, and yet there was data all the way up to 9:57 p.m. She readjusted the parameters to cover the time span from 9:57 p.m. on the 5th until a minute ago. This time the routine finished in only a few minutes. No spreadsheet was created because there was no information. While Patterson's phone had definitely gone off network on April 5th, it had happened nearly 2 hours after the processed records indicated, which meant those records had been manipulated to cover up the true time. She jumped back into the real records to check on the phone's location for the phantom time. From 8:08 onward, Patterson's cell had moved progressively from one tower to the next. Given the number of zones covered and the distance between them, the woman must have been in a vehicle. Rosario built a map from the data that showed Patterson heading northeast out of town on the highway for 20 miles, at which point she had stayed in a single zone for 52 minutes. After that, the phone headed north again, going an additional 33 miles before it abruptly stopped registering. She brought up a satellite image of the area where the signal stopped. "Huh," she muttered. The last zone extended over the eastern half of the only bridge to cross the Columbia River between Bradbury and the Canadian border. According to the raw data, the phone had been within the tower's operating sphere a bit longer than it had been in each of the previous 5 towers. Had Patterson switched it off and gone north to Canada, or maybe west, eventually to Seattle? Or maybe she jumped off the bridge. The administrator had not indicated the woman might be suicidal, but it couldn't be ruled out. Rosario found photos of the bridge from several angles. It was high, but with the increased level spring runoff would bring, not high enough to guarantee death, unless a jumper aimed for the pilings. But that would not go unnoticed, especially not for 2 weeks. She searched for mentions of recent bridge suicides, but there were none. The last reported suicide attempt happened 7 years ago, and the would-be jumper was talked out of it. She checked for reports of bodies that had been found in the river between the bridge and the Cooley Dam to the south. There were more of these than jumpers, but not many. And again, none in the past few months. Okay, she likely didn't jump from the bridge or get thrown over. Then why did her phone go off right there? As Rosario considered the different possibilities, her phone rang. She picked it up, assuming Ananka was calling, but Ricky's name glowed on the display. What? She asked.
Hello to you too.
I am busy.
And I'm not. I'm just sitting here in my room watching reruns of Judge Judy. A person can only watch her deal with these imbeciles for so long. I tried calling Ananka, but she didn't answer. I thought maybe you could use some help. Ricky's here. Ricky should be doing something.
Sorry to disappoint you. You are going to have to wait for Ananka. I really...
Rosario, for all that is holy, I'm finally off the boat and I gotta stay in this room? I can't do that. It'll drive me crazy.
You were only on the boat for a few days.
You're missing the point. You gotta have something I can do. Anything, please.
Rosario was about to tell him no again, but then an idea hit her, one she was sure Ananka would approve.
There actually might be something. How would you like to go for a ride?
A ride? Yes, I love that idea. Where?
She gave him the location of the bridge and told him about the woman's phone.
Have a look around. If she jumped, then she would have left her car around there somewhere.
You think she killed herself?
Unlikely, but still a possibility.
So you're sending me on a wild goose chase?
I am sending you to investigate a lead, or would you rather continue watching your Judge Judy?
Whoa, not complaining, just making an observation. Count me in. What kind of car does she drive?
Rosario consulted the information sheet Ananka had texted her.
A Prius, light blue, 2016.
She gave him the license number.
Thanks, Rosie. Don't you worry about a thing. Ricky's on the job.
Ricky vowed to buy the administrator a beer the next time he saw him for hooking Ricky up with the motorcycle. It was a Yamaha SCR950. Not a Harley, but still a sweet ride with a nice retro feel. Really, though, any bike would have been fine. To feel the motor between his legs? Man, there was nothing like it. He had to fight the urge to let the thing fly after he rolled out of the hotel parking lot, but while he was still in Bradbury, he had to play it cool. Once he reached the countryside, he let her rip. The road snaked northward between the river on his left and the tree-filled hills on his right. There were a few other vehicles on the road. He couldn't have asked for a more beautiful trip. It took him 43 minutes to reach the guardrail-lined ramp leading up to the bridge. The crossing was half trestle, half whatever the hell engineers called open air, with the latter being the side covered by the last cell tower to register Patterson's phone. If the woman had jumped, there were plenty of spots to choose from. And if traffic had been as light then as it was now, she could have made her leap without anyone seeing. Upon reaching the other end of the bridge, Ricky U-turned and headed back across. This time, instead of driving all the way to the end, he stopped where the trestle and open sections met and parked as far to the side as he could. He stepped over a short guardrail onto a narrow walkway used by pedestrians wanting to cross. Along the outer edge of the bridge was a nearly continuous, waist-high metal barrier. The only breaks came from parapets that flanked the bridge, one on each side, both sticking out 3 feet over the river. They were located right at the point where the two sections met. Solid concrete walls, same height as the barrier, on three sides, leaving only the sides facing the road open. Ricky stepped onto the parapet nearest him and looked down. With the water rushing by below, this would have been a lovely place from which to take one swan dive. He glanced at the east bank, thinking there was a good chance the cell tower's coverage reached this far. Though he didn't expect to find anything, he spent a few moments looking around for signs that someone had been there recently, and then crossed to the parapet on the other side. He found nothing of value. He remounted the bike and headed back to land. At the near end of Northport, he stopped at a restaurant and ordered the barbecue ribs and onion rings, hoping they wouldn't insult his taste buds. He was foolish to worry.
"How is the meal?" the waitress asked when she came to clear his dishes.
"If I'm being honest, I'd have to say your ribs have shoved their way into my top 10 best ever list."
"Not number one?"
"It's a pretty tough list."
When she finished picking up everything, she asked,
"Can I interest you in some pie?"
"Don't tempt me. Just the check, please."
"Your loss."
She returned a few moments later with the bill. He handed her more than enough cash to cover it.
"Keep the change."
"Why, thank you. You have yourself a good day."
"Before you go, can I ask you a question?"
She smirked, as if waiting for him to say exactly that.
"Sorry, buddy, married."
"You've broken my heart, but that actually wasn't my question."
She looked at him, waiting.
"If someone left a car parked around here for a week or two, what would happen to it?"
"You left a car here?"
"Not me, a friend. He was supposed to pick it up a week ago, but, you know, things happened. Told him I'd check on it since I was heading this way."
"Oh, well, the side of her mouth scrunched up. "If no one reported it, I would think it would still be where he left it."
"And if someone had?"
"I don't know. Sheriff, I guess. There's a substation in the middle of town. You might try there."
"Thanks for your help."
He drove around the area searching for a light blue Prius. He came across three of the hybrids, but none was the right color. He checked the plates anyway, in case the color info had been wrong. No match. He did a drive-by of the sheriff's station, too. No Priuses in the lot. It could have been moved to a larger, county-wide holding area, but he doubted it. In that case, it would be in the system, and the administrator would have been alerted. Ricky's hunter senses were telling him the car had never been left here. The most likely scenario was that Patterson, or someone, had tossed her mobile out a car's window as it drove across the bridge. He reported his findings to Rosario and headed back south. A middle-aged Caucasian guard stepped from the hut at the entrance to Greenhills Estates and leaned down to look into the sedan.
"Mrs. Mahoney, good to see you," he said.
"Good afternoon, Joseph. Wondering if you could let us in for a little look around?"
Joseph noticed Ananka. The tightening of the muscles in his face was subtle, but Ananka picked up on it immediately. She'd experienced that look so many times she'd lost count. It was like he wanted to say, what is she doing here? The joys of a world still peppered with ignorance and stupidity. She beamed a smile and gave him a friendly wave, just to make him feel a little more uncomfortable.
Of course, Mrs. Mahoney, Joseph said flustered. Let me get the gate for you.
As they drove in, Ananka stared at the guard, her friendly smile morphing into an I'm on to you glare only he could see. From the increasing discomfort on his face, her message was received.
There are 29 lots in the estates, Tony said, blissfully unaware of Ananka and Joseph's silent exchange. The smallest are 3 acres, the largest over 20. At this point, less than half the lots have homes.
She switched to her sharing a secret whisper.
It's not cheap to buy in here, but that's what keeps it exclusive.
The road wound around a hill and dipped into a partially wooded valley hidden from the highway. Ananka could see 4 mansions spread across the valley to the right, and the signs of several others scattered among the trees straight out and to the left.
When I was a kid, this all belonged to the Lindens farm. You see that pond over there?
Tony pointed way off to the left, where a small body of water sparkled in the daylight.
I was friends with Jenny Linden, and she'd throw swimming parties there in the summer. So much fun.
Things look like they've changed a lot since then. Tony laughed.
That's putting it mildly. When Scholarian moved here, I don't think anyone realized what was going to happen.
They were the first?
Not quite the first, but they were the biggest to relocate here. They've grown even more since then. Mr. Scudder employs over 300 people now. Back then, it was probably a third of that. He's also helped the town entice several other companies to move here. You see that smoke?
She pointed at a thin column rising above the trees.
That's Mr. Scudder's house. Did I mention that he'll be at the meet and greet tomorrow night?
You said it was a possibility.
Oh, I'm sure he'll be there. He never misses that kind of thing. It's going to be a really fun evening.
I'm sure it is. Tony drove them around Green Hills, pointing out the different houses, though more often than not, the only thing visible was a long driveway, a few of which were gated. Ananka nodded and commented as required. As they headed up the hill back toward the main gate, Tony said,
And that's Green Hills Estates. What did you think?
It's beautiful.
Do you think your CEO would be happy here?
I think anyone would be happy here.
I couldn't have said that better myself. Anywhere else specific you'd like to check out?
Ananka made a show of looking at the time on her phone. Actually, I need to be heading back to the hotel. I have a conference call soon and some other work to deal with.
Of course. We can finish the tour next time you're available.
That works for me. The gate opened before they reached it. As they drove out, Ananka looked at the guard hut, but asshole Joseph remained hidden inside. 8. The charter jet landed on a private runway 51 miles northeast of Bradbury, 7 miles south of the Canadian border. 3 Range Rovers and a pickup truck waited next to the automated weather station that provided information for the few flights that used the field. When the plane came to a stop, the vehicles pulled up to its side. 6 passengers disembarked, all strangers to each other. Due to the nature of their trip, conversations on the flight had been basically non-existent, a pattern of similar flights filled with other strangers. A young man stood near the base of the stairs and directed each passenger to one of the waiting Range Rovers, while 2 other men loaded luggage into the bed of the pickup. The drive to the lodge took 20 minutes, and by the time the building came into view, the sun had set and stars had filled the sky. The lodge was 3 stories tall and large enough to house at least 50 guests. From its pitched roof rose 5 chimneys. The place had the look of a quaint mountain hotel one might escape to for a weekend away from the city. The SUV stopped under a portico, and the same young man who'd been at the plane directed the guests to the main entrance. The ornate double doors opened onto a large room 2 stories high. A fireplace roaring with flames sat in the center of the room. Facing it were several soft leather couches and chairs arranged in 2 arcs. A 2nd-floor balcony stretched across the room, reachable at either end by a spiral staircase. There were several doors off the big room and a hallway to the left. The new arrivals were the only people present.
Hello?
The first man who entered said. He had made millions in Eastern Europe by cheaply converting old buildings into apartment complexes and then renting them out at exorbitant rates. As for his name, they had all been instructed to leave identifications behind before boarding the flight in New York. They would be given temporary identities for the duration of their stay. Another man, the second youngest in the group and heir to a large clothing company, spotted a bar beyond the arc of chairs and headed over to it. When two of the others realized where he was going, they followed. Both were older than the heir, but their money was newer. One had struck it rich by playing the market, while the other had earned his cash from a growing network of fast food franchises in the American Southeast. The heir poured himself a whiskey neat and offered to do the same for the other two men. The fast food magnate accepted, while the investor preferred making himself a rum and coke.
"Hello,"
the slumlord repeated, cupping his hands around his mouth. The final two men, the oldest and youngest of the group, decided they too wanted something to drink. The oldest man, barely in his 60s, was the retired founder of a budget airline that operated throughout the Mediterranean. He now enjoyed a life of leisure funded by the millions he'd earned from paying his employees shit. The youngest guy was a new breed of entrepreneur who had started and sold three different companies for insane profits before his 29th birthday. Their drinks of choice were a glass of Cabernet and a bottle of water, respectively. The slumlord finally decided to join the others.
"Someone should have been here to greet us,"
he said as the heir handed him a whiskey on the rocks.
"It is very rude."
"You're right,"
a female voice said behind him. They turned en masse to find a beautiful woman with long brown hair smiling down at them from the second floor balcony. She wore a green calf-length dress that matched her eyes and could have been anywhere from 23 to 30.
"I'd like to welcome you all to Stanhope Lodge. I apologize for the delay, and I do hope you can forgive me. The nature of our gathering, as I'm sure you can imagine, requires us to limit the amount of people involved. This occasionally means having to do double duty." She descended the stairs nearest the men. "Perhaps one of you would be kind enough to pour me a glass of Pinot Noir." The only two who didn't immediately spring into action were the retired airline CEO and the slumlord. Of the others, the heir won the day, laying his hand on the correct bottle before the other spotted it.
"Thank you," she said as he fulfilled her request. Glass in hand, she said,
"Gentlemen, if you will please have a seat."
After the guests made themselves comfortable, the woman stepped in front of the hearth and faced them.
"We are so glad you are finally here."
She walked over to the mantel and removed several envelopes from inside a wooden box.
"These contain key cards to your rooms and approved areas of the lodge. If you lose your card, contact me immediately. Failure to do so will result in a non-refundable termination of your stay."
The slumlord opened his mouth to say something, but she lifted a finger to cut him off.
"I know you all have questions, but I ask that you refrain for now, as most of your queries will be answered in due course."
She walked over to the entrepreneur and handed him the top envelope.
"You are Mr. Wells, and you will be staying in the Nuriki suite, south wing, upstairs."
She gestured toward the appropriate stairs. He started to stand, but she touched his shoulder.
"Please wait until everyone is ready."
She moved on to the slumlord.
"You are Mr. Houston, and will be staying in the Runda suite."
She pointed the way and moved on again. She handed out the rest of the cards and revealed their temporary names: Mr. Ford, Mr. Hawks, Mr. Wise, and Mr. Reed. After the last envelope was distributed, she said,
"You are free to go to your rooms and freshen up, but please return here within the hour and fix yourself another drink. I will collect you when dinner is ready."
"Where's Mr. Lean?"
Ford, the fast food king, asked. Mr. Lean, they had been told after their participation fees were received, was the name of their host.
"Mr. Lean will join us at the first trial."
"What do we call you?"
the heir, now known as Reed, asked.
"I am Miss Riefenstahl."
9. The Brazen Diner filled the ground floor of one of the historic brick buildings on Main Street. While its name implied it possessed an unconventional menu, the choices were standard fare: French dips, patty melts, grilled ham and cheese sandwiches, and the old standby chicken fried steak. The most exotic item was the Caesar salad, but from the look of the one a customer was chomping on a few booths away from Ananka and Rosario, it wasn't worth the risk. Ananka settled for the tomato soup and a side of toast, while Rosario opted for the roasted chicken breast with rice and green beans. Neither option turned out to be particularly impressive. As Ananka popped the last bit of toast in her mouth, the bell above the main entrance dinged.
"Oh, great," she muttered. Rosario raised an eyebrow.
"Riki?" Ananka shook her head. "Officer Harris." In contrast to Ananka's disposition, Rosario's expression brightened.
"Oh, really?"
The cop, dressed in jeans and a nice turquoise top, paused just inside and scanned the room for an empty table. When her gaze landed on Ananka, one corner of her mouth ticked up and she started walking again. Ananka groaned and said, her lips barely moving, "I think she's coming over here."
"Why?
How the hell should I know?" Ananka tracked Harris's approach from the corner of her eye and waited until the woman reached their booth before looking directly at her.
"Well, Officer Harris, what an unexpected pleasure. What brings you here?"
"It's dinner time."
At that moment, Ananka and Rosario's waitress walked by.
"Evening, Morgan," the woman said. "What'll it be tonight?"
"I'm thinking chicken fried steak."
"Spinach and onion rings?"
"You know me too well."
The waitress smiled and walked off.
"Sounds like you eat here a lot," Ananka said.
"Every night. Pre-shift ritual."
"Everybody's gotta have a thing, right? Is there something I can help you with, officer?"
Harris made a show of glancing down at her clothes.
"I'm not in uniform. You can call me Morgan."
"Is there something I can help you with, Morgan?"
"I just thought I'd check to make sure you didn't have any problems finding your hotel."
"I would have thought you knew that already. I mean, since you followed me all the way there."
A small smile.
"We try to be a full-service department."
"Is that so?"
Harris glanced at Rosario and then back at Ananka.
"Are you going to introduce me to your friend?"
"I wasn't planning on it."
Harris held her hand out to Rosario.
"I'm Morgan."
Rosario shook it.
"Caroline."
"A pleasure to meet you, Caroline. So, what brings you ladies to our little town?"
"You part of the official greeting committee?"
Ananka asked, forcing a smile.
"Just a local wanting to make sure you're enjoying your stay."
"We are, thanks."
Ananka stared at Harris, making it clear she wasn't going to add anything else. Harris held her gaze for a moment before saying,
"I'll let you get back to your meal then. Enjoy your evening."
"Appreciate that, Morgan," Ananka said.
Harris tilted her head and walked toward an empty table across the room.
"Can you believe her?" Ananka said as she watched the cop go. "The pictures of her online didn't do her justice. She is stunning."
"Who cares what she looks like?
I don't like the fact she seems a little too interested in us."
"Maybe she has a crush on you."
"Very funny."
"What's funny?"
Rosario glanced over at Harris's table.
"I would be flattered if she had a crush on me."
"Just hurry up and finish. We've got things to do." The big item on Ananka and Rosario's post-dinner agenda was getting a look inside Natasha Patterson's house. For this task, they needed Ricky's help. Ananka called him as they were making their way back to the hotel. After she'd explained his role, he said,
"What do you mean I don't get to go inside?"
"We need eyes on the street. That's you."
"Boring."
"I hope so."
"Come on, hun, you're wasting my talents."
She let the hun go without comment. As far as Ricky's terms of endearment went, it was the least offensive.
"Ricky, do you want to do the job, or do you want to go back to the ship?"
"Fine. If the boss wants to waste Ricky's talents, then Ricky will waste his talents."
"Good. I'm happy to hear that. Now get moving."
"Yes, ma'am."
Ananka and Rosario remained at the hotel until Ricky reported all the lights had gone off in the houses surrounding Patterson's place. They then set out on foot, passing behind the business district, crossing the high school baseball field, and finally hiking through the woods that separated Old Town from the housing development. Patterson's home on Cloud Drive was near the middle of the tract. As best they could, they avoided the spill of street lamps by creeping over front lawns, down alleys, and through the occasional backyard. By 10:27 p.m., they were in the alley behind the missing woman's home. Ananka activated her comm.
"Ricky, how's it looking?"
"I hate to tell you this, but there's an entire SWAT team surrounding the house just waiting for you to make a wrong move."
"Ricky," he snickered.
"I haven't seen a damn thing for almost half an hour. See? Boring. Seriously, I'm dying out here."
"If only we could be so lucky."
"Funny."
Ananka peeked over the fence, confirmed everything was clear before she and Rosario climbed into Patterson's backyard. Crouching next to the flower bed lining the fence, they listened for anything indicating they'd been seen. All remained quiet. Ananka led the way to a raised wooden deck attached to the back of the house, stopping at the base of the steps leading up. She scanned the home for signs of life, but everything was dark. Using her phone's camera, she zoomed in through one of the French doors. The only thing she could see were the shadowy shapes of furniture. She lowered her phone and moved her finger toward the button that would turn the screen off, but before she pressed it, the cell's glow glinted off something on one of the steps. She knelt down for a closer look. Well, looky here. She motioned to Rosario and pointed out what she'd found. Rosario leaned in and then looked at Ananka, her eyebrows raised. Thin monofilaments stretched half an inch above the center of each step, ensuring that even if someone skipped a step or two on the way up, he or she would still step on one of the thin lines, leaving behind evidence someone had been there. Ananka checked under the steps in case the filaments were connected to silent alarms or, God forbid, explosives. They weren't. Had Patterson been worried about intruders and put the traps there herself? That seemed pretty paranoid, not to mention out of character for a typical CFO. But Ananka could think of no other reason. With the stairs a no-go, she and Rosario climbed over the deck's railing and made their way carefully to the house. Ananka checked the French doors for any additional security devices, but they were clean. She signaled for Rosario to do her thing and waited while her colleague used a wand attached to her cell phone to scan for an alarm system. When Rosario finished, she whispered, "She has one, but nothing too fancy. Doors and windows, 4 motion detectors, and 2 interior cameras. These will not take long." She tapped on her phone for half a minute and then slipped it into her pocket. Disabled. Ananka dealt with the locks herself before easing the door open. Not a sound from inside. They moved across the threshold and shut the door. "We're in," she reported over the comm.
"I and the empty streets surrounding you rejoice in your accomplishment," Ricky said.
The first order of business involved checking the entire house to confirm no one else was present, which they accomplished in under 2 minutes. Task 2, a more thorough search. They started on the ground floor. A chef's kitchen, a sunken living room, dining room with a table large enough to seat 12, and a plus-sized family room. Every item in each room had its place, with nothing extraneous lying around. Patterson clearly possessed a meticulous mind. The only thing that seemed off was the thin layer of dust everywhere. No maid service then. Either that or service had been suspended for the last couple of weeks. They checked drawers and cabinets, but found nothing of interest, so they moved to the second floor. 4 generous-sized bedrooms and an open area that served as an upstairs living room took up the entire space. Their first stop was the master suite. Like the rooms on the ground floor, the bedroom was uncluttered and orderly. A look through the walk-in closet gave Ananka a sense of the woman's style, hip while a bit conservative. Patterson apparently enjoyed taking advantage of the local outdoor lifestyle because among the shoes sat 2 pairs of hiking boots, one brand new, the other with well-worn soles. No signs of any male clothes, so if Patterson was seeing someone, the relationship hadn't reached the leave things at the other person's place stage. She checked the hamper. It was nearly filled, all with women's clothing. 2 of the other bedrooms were set up for guests, while the final one had been turned into a home office. They quickly dealt with the guest rooms and moved on to the office, knowing it would take more time. After searching through the desk drawers and checking the closet, Rosario said, "There is a modem and a Wi-Fi router, but no computer. Unless you've seen one somewhere else?" Ananka shook her head. "Maybe she only uses a laptop and took it with her." "Look at the desk," Rosario said. "The whole center area is open." Plenty of people use laptops and keep their desks clear. Rosario knelt in front of the desk and checked underneath. "There is a power strip attached to the side. Very difficult to plug and unplug. Better to plug in once and leave it."
Which, again, doesn't rule out a laptop. She could have multiple cords.
"Then where is the one she would have left here?"
"There's no cord."
"I did not say that." Rosario slapped the female end of a white extension cord on top of the desk. "There is no laptop cord, but there is this one for a desktop machine."
"You knew that already, didn't you?"
Rosario shrugged. "Perhaps." Ananka rolled her eyes.
"Fine. So we have a computer cord without a computer."
"Yes."
"Do you know what type of machine it's for?"
"Not from this," Rosario said, lifting the cord a few inches. "It is generic, but when we get back to the hotel, I can use the modem serial number to figure out what kind of machine accessed the internet from here." Ananka looked around the room. Something else was bothering her. Patterson was in upper management of a tech firm that had relationships with companies around the country. There must have been deals going on all the time, deals that needed the input of the company's CFO. It seemed likely for Patterson to be called upon to travel now and then, but... Have you seen any luggage? Rosario cocked her head.
No, I have not.
If she went somewhere, she would...